This is Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B.
Hello there. Welcome to Life Elsewhere. I'm Norman B. A very special conversation coming up in the next 60 minutes. The gentleman I'm about to talk to has made some of the most important and influential records of the past three decades or more. Beginning in Scotland back in the early 80s, Finny Tribe certainly caught my attention. Then his participation with Ministry, The Revolting Cox, Pigface and more cemented his name firmly in the legacy of industrial music. But he's also released a slew of solo recordings and he's written a number of books. The man's name is Chris Connolly. And what an absolute delight it is to welcome him to Life Elsewhere. Chris has a new album. It's a collaboration with Scottish chanteuse Monica Queen. The title? The Birthday Poems. It's a celebration of the centenary of Scottish poet George Mackay Brown. So to begin, here's a cut from the album. This is My Father Took Me Everywhere. Then, my conversation with Chris Connolly. My Father Took Me Everywhere, from the new album, The Birthday Poems, from Chris Connolly and Monica Queen. I have talked about this album a couple of times before on the program and highly recommend that you check this out. But I also highly recommend that you pay careful attention to my guest. It happens to be the man himself, Chris Connolly. Chris, welcome to Life Elsewhere.
Hello, how are you?
Good, man. This is, as I just said to you in a little preamble that we had, this is kind of remarkable because over the years, I've crossed paths with so many people that you've been involved with, but you and I haven't crossed paths, which is, I'm sure we've been in the same room at one time or another. You know, but here we are having a chat. So it's terrific to see you and terrific to talk to you.
Absolutely.
We've got a lot to talk about. And we're going to talk about the new album, but at a later date, maybe another week, we'll talk more with you about what you've done and music, etc. But let's concentrate right now on the birthday poems. I'm going to ask you the obvious question. How did this come about?
There's sort of two, there are two stories behind it, and they're both true stories. The real story started a long time ago, talking 1980, 81. And I was 15 or 16, and I was friends with the children of the poet Stanley Roger Green. Although I did not know that their father was a poet, the parents were separated. They lived with their mother, Eleanor. And anyway, his daughter mentioned to me one day that her dad wrote poetry. So I went out and found a book. And the book was called The Suburb of Belsen. And it had a poem in it called Bavelaw in Winter. And when I read that poem, it just blew my mind. I thought it was just the most remarkable thing. And it sort of set me, I didn't become obsessed with him. But I really enjoyed his poetry. And then maybe, you know, this is like 30 odd years later, 40 odd years later, I bought, I sort of got reinterested again, and I bought a few more of his books. And one of them is called A Clamjamfrey of Poets. And it's a small book, but it's a really informative book about the Edinburgh poetry scene in the 50s. And there was a chapter about Stella Cartwright and a chapter about George Mackay Brown, and also a chapter he wrote about himself, Stanley Roger Green, giving his story. And I really got interested in their relationship, but I also got interested in the idea that this woman who was, for all intents and purposes, a muse to these poets, also was an incredible creative force herself, but was not able to express that creativity for whatever reasons. The time, she was a woman, it was the 50s, it was Edinburgh, the poets were a boys' club, etc., etc. So I went down this road of research and turned up with very little. In fact, there's not much about her. So my original idea was to write a book, because I have written books before, and I have written a fiction before, and I wanted to write a historical fiction because I thought the story was so great. But it was really hard because, you know, all these people are dead.
Yeah.
There's only a few survivors, one of whom, Dolina McLennan, who's also a parent of one of my oldest friends. She was around, she's still around, she's in her 80s and she's as buoyant as ever. But and she knew all these people a lot because they used to have parties at her house after the pubs closed. But she couldn't tell me that much about Stella. And listen, I know for a fact, because I lived up the road from Stella Cartwright. I know, like we were talking about me and you, I know we were in the same building at the same time.
I used
to work in a supermarket, the only supermarket in that area. And everyone who lived in that area came through that supermarket. So I know when I was a teenager, I probably spoke to her. Anyway, fascinating story. And I abandoned the book idea after I watched this really great interview with Paul Auster. Oh, and Paul Auster was talking about Lou Reed. His pal Lou Reed wanted to write a book and he was having a real hard time. And Paul Auster said, you know what, Lou, you write great songs, do that. And I took that message to heart and started writing songs. I abandoned the book completely and the songs just came flooding out because I'd done all this. I'd done like 2 years of research.
Yeah. How long did it take you to write the songs, to get the album together?
It took 14 days.
14 days.
14 days to write it, yeah. When I started, it was like, you know,
it started flowing.
It came out, and we were in lockdown at the time. And I just every morning, and I knew the chronology of the story, I could map it out. I just had to find what musical background it required, but it was there. It just came out. Mm-hmm. And at that time, you know, I recorded it all myself. And my friend Chris Bruce, who's produced quite a few of my records, he called me and we're talking and he said, "Hey, if you're working on any songs or anything like that, just send them my way." And I said, "Well, actually, I've got this record. Let's start. Let's do this record." And I knew I had to find a female. I had to find Stella. And it wasn't long before I remembered how much I loved Monica Queen's voice. There wasn't yes. many choices for me. It had to be her, you know, it had to be her. So I found her on Facebook and contacted her and, you know, it was all very straightforward and good feeling.
You hadn't worked with her before, had you?
No, I don't even know her. I didn't yeah. even know her. I just really love her voice. And she had heard of me. And also, you know, she gets asked to do a lot of collaborations, but she's very picky about what she did. But she liked the songs a lot and was completely invested in it. So she worked on her parts and I sort of would sing a guide for her and send it to her. But I just said, you know, you have the voice, you do what you do best.
Yes.
And it worked out so well for us.
There's a couple of things I want to talk about the album, The Birthday Poems. One, the production is just superb, Chris. It really is. It caught my attention straight away. The other is I'm one of these strange people that I don't like to put things into categories or genres. I like to mix things up. It's like my shows. I like to mix things up. And so I'm kind of hesitant to say this album falls into this category or that category. What I do like is the way it flows together. And there's another aspect to it, and that is just how you've taken your voice and how you've taken Monica's voice and used it and used both of them just so perfectly for the story that you're telling. It works so well. And then there's one other thing, and then I've got questions for you. The video for my Father Took Me Everywhere. Am I right in thinking that was found footage? What is that? What talk to me no. about that.
That was Monica.
It was Monica. Okay.
Yeah, and a guy called Ian Munch in Glasgow. And there's a film out there called Palindrome by the Scottish filmmaker Margaret Tate. And so they used that. And it's the only footage that we can find of Stella. And so they took that and used it as a springboard to make the video, which I thought was just genius. It was so good.
Yes.
Yeah.
There's another video, as we're talking about videos, and I'm just trying to remember what the cut is. There's one video.
To the Voice.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That is so good.
Yeah, that was great. That was my friends Derek Smith and Matt Walker made the video. Matt directed and Derek shot it, and it was another masterstroke. It was just a brilliant idea they had to have me playing the different sort of poets.
Different role, yeah. Where was that location?
The G-Man in Chicago, which is the bar. I just played a residency there over the weekend. But we did this during lockdown and there was no one there. And it was just me and a bunch of fake cigarettes and fake beer.
Yeah, it works. I mean, and it could be it could be in Glasgow. It could be in Edinburgh. It could be. I mean, it has that sort of feel, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Chris Connolly is my guest, and we're talking about, amongst other things, and it's essential that we focus on this for a little bit here. His new album, it's called The Birthday Poems. He's collaborated with Scottish vocalist Monica Queen on this one. We played one cut. We're going to play some more. And I'm going to ask Chris to select the next one we play. But before we get to that, Chris, putting this album together, I'm getting the feeling from just listening to it, now just talking to you, that this was something that it was, you already said it was inside of you, but I'm getting the feeling that you really thoroughly enjoyed what you did and wanted to do it and was sort of not desperate, but I get the feeling that you wanted to get this out.
I did, yeah. I really did. And it flowed out so easily and quickly. But what made that happen was, unlike an album that I might make, you know, this already had a beginning, middle, and end. And that made it easier, you know, because I knew that Stella dies at the end. And for some reason, that gave it a sort of symmetry and a trajectory to work for. There's 18 songs on the record, or 18 pieces, rather.
Yes.
Some of it is poetry. And when it was done, it was done. And like sometimes on records, you want to like swap something out or add something. But yeah, it was something that I had to get out. And like I said earlier, you know, I'd wanted to do a novel, and it was really kind of breaking my heart that I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Even down to like understanding the vernacular of being sort of Scottish in the 1950s, because I wasn't. I remembered the tail end of that. And
yes,
it kind of informed when I was growing up in the 60s, but I wasn't in pubs, or, you know, I didn't know. But it's funny, since it came out, you know, my mother, who's still alive, was talking about remembering those times, you know.
Yes.
And even peripherally being in the same company as many of these people, as everyone was probably, you know,
right,
in the center of Edinburgh. Yeah. But yeah, it was definitely a project that had to come. I had to do it, and it was burning me, you know.
Select another cut for us, and whilst we're playing it, I'd like you to think about what it was that drove you to celebrate the centenary of the poets. I guess that's the simple part of the question. Yeah, what was it outside of... No, I'm going to leave it like that. I'm going to edit myself. No, yeah.
All right.
So let's choose another cut.
I would play To the Poets.
To the Poets. Okay.
Yeah.
Chris Connolly, selecting To the Poets from the album The Birthday Poems. This is Life Elsewhere.
Standing by myself in the Abbotsford bar, this cloak and dagger drinking has not got me very far. I'm penniless, uncomfortable, but I'm drawn towards a throng. It's Saturday night in the Poets Club, and I want to belong. McCaig is in the corner, Tom Scott is in his cups. Political slander, lively candor, loud to me, but it's never enough. I want to catch their eyes, but I'm too shy to be caught. A poet and his lonely vice, but a Scot is still a Scot. But not the lights and armour, this language runs a charm. Men are found and have more means to the poets. But not the lights and armour, this language runs a charm. And they brought me out my shell, the conversation bubbling up from a bottomless well. The soft tongue of the Orkneys amid this poet's jamboree, but they lend an ear to this quiet man and listen to me. It's sooner stories intertwine, threading the tapestry, the colours of God and politics, a war tranquility. They lose you and they find you, but the verse is always there. If it's Rose Street Lee and a Saturday night, the poets are everywhere.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Chris Connolly. He has a new album. It's called The Birthday Poems. He's collaborated with Scottish singer Monica Queen. We just heard To The Poets. Talk to me about that song, and then I want you to fill in the blank on the question that I asked you earlier.
Yeah. To The Poets is, it happens fairly early in the record. George Mackay Brown had moved from Orkney to Edinburgh to go to Edinburgh Uni. And he was living in a bedsit, and he didn't know anyone. And he always suffered from ill health. And moving to a city in the 50s meant that it was he had bronchitis. Moving to a city in the 50s meant there was a lot of smoke. You know, it was still pretty dirty. So he was sick. He was lonely. He missed Orkney terribly. But he knew about these poets and he wanted to meet them. And he found out where they hung out at the Abbotsford Bar. That's one of the bars they would
yes.
hang out in Rose Street. And he went there, but he was way too shy to approach them. So To The Poets is him standing by himself in the Abbotsford Bar. And eventually one of them came over and invited him, and he was still too shy. But eventually he made his way over. And when he did, things opened up for him. He was a very witty man and had a great sense of humor, and they loved him. And he was also, you know, I mean, worshipped as a writer. I mean, his writing is just incredible. So he wasn't some poser poet, you know. He already had been published at that point, you know, maybe a couple of times. So that's what but the other thing about To The Poets, which is there's an irony in it as well, because these guys are in the song toasting themselves to the poets. Yes. And they tell you in the song that they never tell the truth, and they just think they're great, and they're just, you know, they're kind of full of it. This, if you get deeply into reading Stan Green or anything like that, you start to pick up on these things where they'll tell these completely ridiculous stories, and people will say, because it's Scotland, they'll say, oh, shut up, you know. Who are you? Right. But they would gather in the pubs and they would argue politics and religion, and that's all mentioned in the song. It was a symposium, you know, every single night after work, because they all work during the day. They're all teachers and things like that.
And that's part of it, isn't it? That it was all getting together and arguing and talking about poetry, talking about politics, and that whole lifestyle. And I think you've managed to capture it so very, very well in the songs on the album. Hmm. Now let's go to the question that I asked you before.
Yes.
So what was behind that for you, Chris, that sort of... that impetus that made you say, I have to do this?
I think, you know, part of it is that it's a Scottish story, and I'm really, I very much love my country. And
yes.
I very much love the culture. And it's also a Scottish story that is... I don't want to say it's buried. I mean, there's a million brilliant stories, you know, they can't all be, you know, you can't make records out of all of them, or one can't make records out of all of them. But I think it's an interesting story. And I think that it has far more layers to it. There's the fact that it's Scottish. There's the fact that it's a period piece of a period in time that I am interested in. There is the fact that it deals with the intermingling of different writers, and also the fact that I love poetry, but also the fact that it was a really complicated relationship between these guys, you know, like, you know, in a sense, not like Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath.
Right.
But that is a complicated relationship, and it's worth writing about. It's worth noting.
Yes.
But it was similar. You have two very strong, very talented spirits together, and it wasn't always, you know, as you can tell by listening to the album. It's there's some things that happened that were just awful. Like they had terrible times in their relationship.
Yes.
And they were together and apart and together and apart. Not quite sort of Burton and Taylor, but yeah, it got bad and it was fiery. And I thought, oh, this is juicy. You know, let's go. One more thing about that is that I did feel very, very conscious that I was writing a lot of it from a female perspective.
Ah.
And I really wanted to point out that there was a boys club involved. And Stella Cartwright, she was reading, you know, this was the 50s and she was reading, I mean, the early 50s, she was reading like Zola and James Joyce, and not just like reading it. I mean, she loved it like 10 years later, a girl would love the Beatles. Right. She loved Zola like a girl would love McCartney, you know. But because of that, you know, when I hear that, I always think, well, there's a kindred spirit. That person has a fire. They are writing. They want to write. They have something in there. They're recognizing it. And that's why she's obsessed with it, you know.
Is it possible, do you think, that Scottish poets at that time, I'm not going to say were maligned so much as you talked about Sylvia Plath, and I'm just wondering, do you think Scottish poets were not given the credit or the due that they deserved at that moment in time? Or am I just going off base there?
I don't think I could say that with any authority, but you have to remember that a lot of these poets, you know, like I want to say Sidney Goodsir Smith, you know, he wrote in the Scottish vernacular. So
yes,
you know, no one outside of there is going to read it.
Right.
And they were maybe weren't looking for an audience outside of the audience they had. I mean, a lot of these people did really well. But then there's people like Tom Scott who were writing very political things, you know.
Yeah.
But I don't think that's something that is pertinent. I don't think they were striving. I mean, you know, the Scots liked the Scots, you know. And you know, take the sort of the singers from the north of Scotland and people like that. They're singing for their people.
Yes.
At that time. Yeah. Yes. They're not singing in Gaelic because they think they're going to be on the Eurovision Song Contest necessarily, you know. Right. But that's my feeling, though. Like I say, I don't think I'm a particular authority about it.
Right, right. Yeah. But on that note, talking about Scottish poets and Scottish creativity, it has always seemed to me that the Scottish people are very proud people and very proud of, as you said, you're very proud to be where you're from and your heritage. And this comes across, not just with you talking about it, but in the music and poetry and musicians. And I could go down a whole list here that I'm thinking of. Has this been something that you, coming from Scotland, have been conscious of? Or is that something that is always sort of like right there for you? I'm from Scotland. Does that make sense?
I think whatever I write is going to be plugged into the hills.
Yeah.
And it's funny, I was talking in another interview the other day, and someone was asking me about the music of the Birthday Party. I keep saying the Birthday Party because I love that band. The Birthday Poems. And I said, look, I could not have done this and maybe purely reference the music of the times. If I'd done that, it would have been, you know, for want of a better word, a sort of folk record.
Yes.
Like, you know, I used the band The Chieftains. Like something like that. Starting in the 1950s, the popular people with these poets musically were things like Ali Bain, who's a violinist, and, you know, traditional Scottish. And I can't play that music. But to me, you know, when I hear the song, "My Father Took Me Everywhere," and I'm a very intuitive writer, I don't think about the music before I write it, but listening back to it, I'm like, okay, you know, it's 1, 2, 3, 2, 2, 3. It's very Cocteau Twins, you know. And then you add Monica's voice on top, and it's, you know, the Cocteau Twins to me are, you know, absolutely the best Scottish band there is. There's great Scottish bands, but no one comes close to me to sounding like Scotland, like the Cocteau Twins.
That's
do.
So interesting.
Yeah, it's not like Heather and Kilts and, you know, McEwan's Lager and Whiskey. They just sound like the Hills to me. Their spirit is Scotland, you know.
Wow.
And I think that comes across on the record, but also there are certain serendipitous things that happen. Like, I had already written the songs before a lot of the extra instruments were added. So there's sax played on it by Levon Henry, who's an American. And, you know, it to me, I loved the sound of it because it was very sort of like Ornette Coleman sounding. And well, what else did these people listen to back then? You know, there weren't many records, but in the 50s and 60s, there would be jazz, there would be classical, you know.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really interesting that whatever I had done pushed him in that direction. Because again, I never gave Levon any direction. We just asked him to go nuts on the song and do a few takes and see what sounded good.
Where was the album recorded? Because I'm guessing that you did some of it. You were in Chicago, and Monica was
in Glasgow.
Yeah, in Glasgow.
Yeah, she's in Glasgow, and Chris mixed it in New York, and Levon lives in New York, and you know, it was all done virtually, and thank God for that, because you know, we couldn't go to a studio or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah.
During lockdown, so it worked out well.
Working remotely like that, and with one person in one place and another person in another place, does that bring out a different kind of creativity, Chris?
It does, because you can choose when you do it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think you're using a different part of your brain and you're not reacting to the people around you. It's interesting. Monica said to me the other day, she said, "It doesn't sound like we're apart at all. It sounds like we're together." No. And I'm really thankful that she said that, because I'm glad of it. I do miss playing in a room with people. And it's funny because I've been thumbing through this book recently that I've had for years about Van Morrison and his absolute obsession with being in the same room as the musicians.
Yes.
And finding that magic moment when the musicians are playing together. And there's not that, but there are these other things. There are these dice rolling things, you know.
Right.
Like I said, with Levon, he was sent the files and we said, "Have fun with it." But if he'd been there in the studio with me, he might have been able to read my face and it'd be like, "Oh, that sounds great," you know, or something like that when you're with someone.
Yes.
There's a different emotional dynamic involved. And this can be kind of emotion free in a sense, but I really like working by myself, and I do all my work in the very early hours of the morning when there's no one else about. And that, to me, that's when the magic sort of happens. But I do miss playing with people and that what if sort of feeling of like, what if we'd done this in a room together, you know?
Two follow-ups on that. Mm. One, for me, the album, there's a warmth that comes through, which I think is amazing considering that you were all separate. It harmoniously works together. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, you just mentioned about playing live. You've got some dates coming up, I understand. Is that right, that you're going to be doing?
I just played them.
Did you? Okay, yeah. So that's happened then, okay?
Yeah, it happened this weekend. It was just like a few days ago.
But you weren't just doing the songs from the album. You're also doing some reading as well. Is that correct?
I did songs from the album. I did reading, and I did a number of pieces from my back catalog as well. I tried to sort of keep it as dynamic as possible, and you know, it went over really well. People were excited about it. It was good.
Let's play another cut, and I've got another question for you to think about, and that is as you're Chris Connolly, and a lot of people know you from other outfits, from other styles of music, right, that's completely different to what you're doing right now. And I'm interested to know what your reaction is, not people's reaction, but what your reaction is to people that are curious or questioning, how come you're doing this when, you know, you're Mr. Revolting Cox, or, you know, there's a complete difference there. And I just wonder what your reaction is. Let's play another song.
Right.
And then we'll come back to that question. What are we going to hear? Yeah.
Phantom Marriage.
Oh, Phantom Marriage. Yes. Okay. This is Phantom Marriage from the Birthday Poems album, Chris Connolly and Monica Queen. This is Life Elsewhere.
Phantom marriage. The day I dropped down on one knee. I've had some time to think, and I've tried hard not to drink. I hope I can convince you to agree. Ah, Stella, my love. Ah, you can rise above street bars where you nightly come to life. And you can have a door key to a place we'll find an Orkney. Stella Cartwright, will you be my wife? How happy I made her, but it wasn't supposed to be. This tortured love is a question mark, and I find it hard to breathe. Ah, but you did no finger pointing. She just gently took my hand, and she asked, is something wrong? Was the prospect just too daunting? I'll be your lover, I'll be your Grace George. Just lead me to your land.
My guest is Chris Connolly. He has a new album. It's called The Birthday Poems, which he's collaborated with Monica Queen and a number of very, very fine musicians. This is a very different album, Chris, to music that you've made in the past. And I'm thinking right now of Revolting Cox, Ministry, Pigface. People must question it. They must come up to you and say, Chris Connolly, and that question mark that they have, what's your reaction to that? What's your thoughts about that?
Well, these days, it doesn't bother me at all. I'm grateful for what I've had and what I do and blah, blah, blah. It used to, maybe about 25 years ago, when I was really trying to break away from that, it used to bother me because I had become far more obsessed with writing music and singing songs, being a songwriter. I never really got into technology to sort of branch off on my own and make a sort of baby Nine Inch Nails record or whatever.
Yeah.
I always feel like I was a player in a bigger play, a character actor, and which is fine. And, you know, I appreciate it. And I made a lot of good friends and a lot of people liked it. A lot of people who like that stuff have grown with me, and especially now more that a lot of these people are my age, they're in their mid-50s.
Yeah.
And they really enjoy what I've done as a solo artist, and I can say, well, you know, there's like 25 albums, go out.
Yes.
And buy them.
Yeah.
But I used to get a lot of pushback about it, and it was frustrating for everybody. But then, you know, in recent years, especially starting with the Wax Trax retrospectacle, which happened like 11 or 12 years ago.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When that was the first time sort of the Revolting Cocks reformed and played something. And at that time, it was like, oh, this is fun. So it's my own fault. I mean, I kind of dipped my toe back in and then did a few more industrial records, and it felt good again. Like, what I say to these people is, I always use my example is Martin Amis, who's one of my favorite writers. I say, well, this guy wrote, you know, Lionel Asbo, and he also wrote Money, and he also wrote The Pregnant Widow. And I mean, they're all radically different books, but they're definitely Martin Amis books.
Yes.
Right? Some of them are like body and this and that, and some of them are way more introspective, but they're all from his pen, and you can tell. And so, not that I'm lifting myself up onto that pedestal, but I say that's what a person can do, you know? I mean, you don't have to stay in that box. And now I don't care to stay in any kind of box. I'll do what I like. And, you know, since sort of streaming music has stolen every penny, I'm like, well, what? So what?
Yeah.
It's fun. You know, I'm having a good time. I am not content to sit and do what's expected of me, because who wants to do that, you know?
Thank you for that answer. I'm really pleased that I asked you that, because you explained it, which now leads me, you just said something, and this is what I like about these kind of conversations, that you is, where do you go from here, Chris? Is the future important to you, what you do creatively?
Yeah, it's everything to me. Yeah, it is. And, you know, I said this also in an interview recently, and I always get it, and it's almost comical, but the day my record comes out, like the day a box came from the record company to my door with finished copies of the record, I look at it, I get a little thrill, and my mind switches over.
Yes.
What's next? Always what's next. I read this really, it was an excerpt from an interview with Bert Jansch, and he was talking about, you know, words to the effect that his life was punctuated by records, and I can't start another record until the other one is done. I have to have closure.
Right.
I can't work on different things concurrently. And I used to say that I could, but it was just, you know, it's impossible for me. I have to have that child put to bed before I start conceiving another child, you know.
I was going to share another somebody else's quote with you. I remember one time I did a number of interviews with David Bowie, and one time I said to him, David, what pisses you off? And he said, not having one good idea a day.
I understand that. That's so cool. I mean, ideas are around all the time, and I get several good ones today just from hearing peripheral conversations or misreading things. I get great ideas from having bad eyesight. like I'll read something like, that's a great song title. And then it says, oh, it says monosodium glutamate. I thought it said something completely different. And it'll start this whole thing. I'm always excited about it, you know.
I want to, as I said at the intro, I want to come back and have another conversation with you.
Yes.
We'll go off. Here's a question for you. This is tied in with your album. It's tied in with the future. And it's about the world we live in right now. You mentioned a little while ago about streaming and about how things have changed. And I, in the conversations I have with artists, it does seem that there's a different kind of attitude about working these days. Some people are so incredibly excited about the technology that's available, and that they can work from their laptop in their home. Mm-hmm. And for Chris Connolly, just the world we live in right now, just some thoughts that come into your mind about the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Mm. Well, you know, I am excited that I can make records at home. I am excited that I can demo things out here and share files. And, you know, I come from an era where when I first started out in music, me and my bandmates would have to save up for ages to get a day in the studio. It was so expensive.
Sure.
And that never stopped. And, you know, being beholden to a record company, you know, which could often go sour, but you needed someone to sort of foot these bills. I like that I can do what I do, but at the same time, I have another job that I do. I don't rely on going on the road to make money. A lot of musicians that I'm close with do, and the last year has been hell on them.
Yes.
And, you know, you take away going out and playing gigs, and then you try and get some royalties from whatever, Spotify or something.
Yeah.
That's not going to happen. And that's a shame. It's a new kind of... it's a new kind of way of looking at music now, but that's just because I come from a different era. Somebody who's starting out now is going to think differently about it. And there was so much about the good old days that was just awful, you know, and so hard. And I'm really grateful that I have had these opportunities and sort of seen when CDs were invented and like having my first CD and like, oh, whoa, and then having CDs kicked to the curb. And
yeah,
you know, one of the things that really annoys me is that I'm not bothered that vinyl is popular again. That's great. But it really, you know, if you press records, it costs so much money. And how are you ever expected to make anything back? And it's kind of expensive. And I like to buy music, and I still do buy music. And I feel if I hear something that's being streamed that I really like, I'll buy it new. And I'll try and buy it from the record company. Because what I do see these days is there are a lot of almost boutique labels just putting out really amazing records, limited edition of 5.
Yes, you know, yes.
But it's so cool.
So
there's a lot of good, a lot of undiscovered music. And I, like yourself, I am complete music nerd. And comb the internet for strange records, and then when that strange record is reissued for under $100, I'm really excited.
Yes.
But I do feel, you know, I used to make a fair living from royalties and stuff like that, and that's not there anymore. But I'm a very fortunate man, you know. I'm not relying on it.
You like your life right now, don't you? I mean, let's be serious about it. You've had an interesting life.
Yeah, it's been fairly interesting.
And we'll talk about that again at another time. Yeah. But here you are at this point. You're still relatively a young man. You're knocking on the door of 60, which is not a bad thing. You know, but with that comes maturity, and it comes experience, and you know some of the pitfalls. But, and I get the feeling you're probably like me, that you still trip over every so often.
I do. I mean, one of the things I've learned, and I'm paying very close attention to my body, you know, I cannot sing ministry songs now. I couldn't go on tour with ministry. I couldn't do that now.
Yes.
It would be impossible. I would lose my voice after one show, and it would probably be 2 weeks before I got it back. Those days are gone, but I got to do it. So there's that kind of awareness, and there's that kind of feeling of starting to forget things. It takes me longer to memorize lyrics and stuff like that.
But
I've got a lid on it. I'm not out on the road right now, like screwing up or anything like that. I have control over it, and I am aware of it. I'm you know, when people who are younger than me saying, "Ah, you're as old as you feel," I'm like, I want to be aware of how old I feel. I think it's important. You got to say hello to these different things in your body and your mind.
You do.
And just own them, and know that it's, you know, I read this interview with Bowie. It was after his heart attack, and he said he'd been really angry because he realized he wasn't going to be doing this forever. And that really resonated with me.
Yeah.
But I didn't want to feel angry about it. I do one of the, and I have a song about it actually. And a lot of the songs on my last but one record were for Bill Rieflin. And it was because my big fear is not being able to do this because of illness or something like that.
Right. And, we should just let everybody know, for those people that are not familiar with the name, who Bill Rieflin is. Somebody that both you and I knew Bill when he was a teenager. You know, back in Seattle. And Bill, of course, was one of the best drummers I've ever seen.
Of course.
You know, and he played with you in ministry. Gosh, what he was in with
REM.
REM, yes.
The Swans.
Started off in the Blackouts in Seattle Bay way back in the,
and ended up in King Crimson, his favorite.
In King Crimson, of course. But as the reason that Chris is talking about Bill is that Bill suddenly and very sadly passed away. Probably one of the most loveliest gentlemen that I've ever had the pleasure to know. Just a lovely man.
So he was ill and he died, and when he towards the end, you know, we had been planning to work together again, and I would have gone out to Seattle, but he, you know, the frequency of him not being able to play got quite accelerated and more frequent. And so it never happened, but I'd started writing these frameworks for songs, and it ended up being a record. And there's songs, a lot of songs on it deal with the idea of, you know, he stopped playing drums in King Crimson because he couldn't play them anymore, but he became the musical director and played keyboards. But it must have really, on a very personal level, hurt him a lot and frustrated him a lot, you know, I can only imagine. So, you know, I don't care that I can't sing like ministry anymore. It's really, I'm at peace with that, because it was always really hard. And it always was so headache inducing. And I'm looking forward to seeing where my voice goes, you know, as I get older. I have no doubt that it's going to be good. It's going to change for the better, whatever happens, as long as I don't smoke.
Have you given up smoking?
Yeah, I haven't smoked since 2000 and gosh, 2002.
Good for you.
So almost 20 years.
That's a long time, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Unfortunately, and I, this is the part that I hate saying, time is always against us, and we have to wrap. But yeah. I'm going to tell you right now, I have thoroughly enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, me too. It was really lovely.
And we are going to do this again, maybe in a week's time. And let's just talk talk about all kinds of stuff. And this album, fantastic. Of course.
Fantastic.
I have been talking to the very lovely, the very charming, and just a very talented man. And it's just what a pleasure to be able to speak to you in person. What a delight. Chris Connolly has been my guest. His new album is called The Birthday Poems, which also features Monica Queen. It really is a terrific album.
Thank you so much.
You're a delight. Thank you so much, my friend.
Thank you so much, Norman. Take care. I'll speak to you soon.
Now, your feedback is important. Let me know what you think of Life Elsewhere. My email address comes up in the closing credits. For the latest new releases, make sure you pop on over to Life Elsewhere Music. Details are up at lifeelsewhere.co. Till next time, be well, be safe, and always, you know, it costs absolutely nothing. Be nice. Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Life Elsewhere, created and hosted by Norman B. Life Elsewhere is written and produced by Norman B. Guest booking and additional research by Stephanie Lane. Behind the scenes assistance by James Van, Bruce Goodman, and Allison Klein. We love to hear what you think about Life Elsewhere. Send your questions, queries, and comments to info@lifeelsewhere.co. That's C-O.